Jesus has been trying to tell them, but they will not hear it, just as they do not hear the teachings on discipleship, the message of the abundance of the kingdom of God, or the call to be the one who serves. Three times on this journey to the holy city, Jesus has told the disciples he must suffer, that he will be betrayed, tortured, and then executed, but on the third day rise again. And each time the disciples have responded in totally inappropriate ways, indicating not only that they are not hearing what Jesus is trying to tell them, but they apparently have not really comprehended any of the gospel message he has been teaching the last several years they have been with him. The first time Jesus had the discussion with them was immediately after he healed the blind man at Bethsaida. He was walking with the disciples afterwards. He asked them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter responds, "You are the Messiah." He then tells them for the first time that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering, die, and rise again. Peter, on the very heels of this great insight, criticizes for Jesus speaking this way. We all remember as Jesus then sternly rebukes Peter, pointedly saying, "Get behind me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." The disciples, the crowd, and all of us are then called upon to deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow Jesus. The second time Jesus tells his disciples, they are passing through Galilee. He again explains to them he is to be betrayed, executed, and will rise again. We are told that they not only do not understand, but they are afraid to ask. Fear and silence have now entered their hearts. As they continue on their way, the disciples then engage in an apparently animated conversation about which one of them is the greatest. Jesus calls them on this and then teaches them that whoever is to be the greatest is to be the least. Whoever wants to be first must be last and servant of all. Of course, they still don't get it. As they continue on their way toward Jerusalem, Jesus continues in his teaching, delivering the difficult lessons we have explored over the last few weeks, difficult lessons of faith and discipleship. You remember the unsettling reading about chopping off hands and feet, gouging. And last week, the lesson was about the poor rich man who was unable to give up his worldly focus to take advantage of his invitation to discipleship given by Jesus himself. And throughout, Jesus continually teaches the great reversal of the kingdom of God, that the first shall be last and the last will be. As they near Jerusalem, Jesus tells them a third time, it is his third passion prediction and comes immediately before our reading today. This is the third and final time Jesus had told them of what is to come, and this time it is the most specific. The events of Holy Week begin to unfold in the chapter immediately following this one, a mere 7 verses later. And Jesus gives much more detail this time. Now he tells them that not only will he be betrayed in Jerusalem to the religious authorities, but that he will be handed over to the Gentiles for further humiliation and torture before being put to death. That can only mean the Romans, and that can only mean crucifixion, a most brutal, painful, and humiliating way to die. Almost as an afterthought, we are told that, and after 3 days, there is another interesting twist in this third passion prediction as they approach Jerusalem. The first two times Jesus has spoken of this issue with the disciples, he has spoken only of himself. In this third telling, he has shifted the verb to the plural. He takes them aside and tells them, "We are going up to Jerusalem." All of a sudden, the disciples are drawn into the events about to unfold. So are we. What immediately follows shows us once again that those in closest association with Jesus still do not understand his message, even as his public ministry is about to draw to a close. It's the Zebedee boys, John and James, nicknamed Boanerges, sons of thunder, who now approach Jesus with an inappropriate request. They were the first two disciples called in Mark, hence they have been with Jesus the longest. Along with Peter, they are Jesus' inner circle among the disciples. These three have witnessed the transfiguration. Yet still hearing only messianic glory and focused on worldly desires, they request that places of honor be reserved for them in the coming kingdom of God. They really do not get it. Jesus tries to gently tell them things will be much different than they expect. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? He asks them. In their blindness and naivete, they blithely answer, "We are able." They have no idea. James will indeed drink this cup much sooner than the rest, traditionally being the first of the disciples to be martyred. He was beheaded by King Herod Agrippa in 44. When the others hear of this, they become angry, probably because they didn't think of it first. I can see a big fan argument brewing. Can you imagine a single father with 12 grown sons all acting like children? And again, Jesus tries to tell them the message that is woven throughout the gospel. Whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. It is the familiar message of the reordered world of abundance and blessing in the coming kingdom, when the first will be last and the last will be first. It is his explaining of the role of suffering servant Messiah. So how do we hear this message today? I dare say most, if not all of us, find it much too easy to focus on our worldly desires and ambitions, often with little regard for either the responsibility or the consequences. I almost always find it easier, actually, I probably always find it easier, and certainly much more fun to anticipate the glory than to consider the preparation, the homework, the practice, the reality. With a winning lottery ticket about to be worth over $1.5 billion this week, $1.5 billion, we can all dream of wealth, power, and a really big house. Our politics and our national dialogue seem especially dominated and controlled by the kingdoms of this world these days. Opposing sides demonize and shout each other down rather than attempt any real communication or understanding. Those in power ruthlessly use any tactic available to maintain themselves in power regardless of the consequences. When problems arise, they are, of course, someone else's fault. Responsibility, accountability, factuality all seem to be deflected. Individual glory and success take precedence over the life of the community. How little has changed, it seems, since the time of the Herod. Let us instead take our opportunity to try to hear this message anew, to really hear it, and to honestly try to understand what it may mean for each of us. Is it time to perhaps re-examine our pursuit of worldly ambition, or at least our relation to it? Is it time to perhaps reconsider our life of service, or at least our relation to it? How might we incorporate these gospel principles into our life, into our work, into our local, national, and global priorities? Discipleship is not easy. The teachings of these last few chapters of Mark have been challenging. The disciples' responses have shown, they've shown us how difficult it can be for any of us fully comprehend their meaning, let alone incorporate them into our lives. Yet as disciples, we are called to follow him in whose service is perfect freedom. Are we able?